Who's taking the lead on this one?
I'm in the report.
Con? Con, is this your first?
First district.
Thank you, welcome then, and again, a reminder to the committee, since it's his first meeting, you have to be nice to him. Paper six.
Thank you. We will move on to agenda paper six, which provides a summary of the feedback received on the proposed amendment to ICE 19 and IFRIC 14. We received 78 comment letters in response to the proposal in the exposure draft. Paper 6A provides a summary of the feedback received on the proposed amendment to IFRIC 14, and Paper 6B provides a summary of the feedback received on the proposed amendment to ICE 19. In each of these papers, we have split the feedback into that which we view as the main issues for deliberation, which are outlined in the main body of the papers, and other issues which we have noted in Appendix A to each of these papers. The purpose of our session today is to explain and discuss the feedback on the main issues. We are not asking the committee to make any decision at this meeting. We plan to provide our analysis of the feedback received together with recommendation on how best to address the feedback at a later meeting. Because the agenda paper is split into different sections, we will outline the main issues for each section and ask you if you have any questions or concerns you would like to raise. While we will not specifically discuss the issues that have been listed in the appendix, we are happy to address any questions you may have on these issues. Over the course of the discussion, it is important to keep in mind that while the discussion will focus on main concerns identified, for most of the issues, at least half of the respondents are in general agreement with the direction of the proposed amendment. Now I will hand over to Jawed, who will work through Agenda Paper 6A. Thank you.
Okay, real quickly, I think it seems to me that the important paragraph in Paper 6 is Paragraph 6, which says this is an information meeting. There's a natural temptation to want to jump on things and say, well, I want to argue about them right now, but we don't have the staff analysis that will provide background for that. So if we can keep that in mind, then all resist temptation. Wade, 6A.
Thank you, Wayne. So I would now like to turn your attention to Agenda Paper 6A. As Khan mentioned, this paper provides a summary of the feedback we received on the proposed amendments to IFRIC 14. These amendments address how an entity assesses the availability of a refund from a defined benefit plan when other parties can wind up the plan or affect benefit for plan members without an entity's consent. So in response to the identified diversity in practice, the board proposed to amend paragraph 12 of IFRIC 14. These amendments are summarized in paragraph 4 to 6 of the agenda paper. Very briefly, these amendments clarify that an entity does not have an unconditional right to a refund if other parties can wind up a plan or use the surplus for other purposes without an entity's consent. The board views these powers as affecting the existence of an entity's right to a refund from a surplus. On the other hand, the board noted that other parties' powers to purchase annuities as plan assets or to make other investment decisions without affecting the benefits for plan members does not affect the availability of a refund. They view such powers as affecting the amount of the surplus rather than the existence of the right to a surplus. In addition, the board also proposed amending paragraph 7 of IFRIC 14 to clarify that when an entity determines the availability of a refund or a reduction in future contribution, the entity takes into account statutory requirements that are substantively enacted, as well as terms and conditions of the plan that are contractually agreed, and any constructive obligations. So in response to these proposed amendments, the main issues that have been identified relate to the proposed amendments to paragraph 12 of IFRIC 14. Those concerns are outlined in paragraphs 20 to 47 of the agenda paper, which begins on page 6 of the agenda paper. In particular, respondents have identified issues relating to certain inconsistencies with existing principles in IS 19 and IFRIC 14. And they're also concerned whether these proposed amendments reflect the economic substance of defined benefit plans, together with a few other substantive issues, which I will just highlight very briefly. So the first issue raised relates to inconsistencies with existing principles of in IS 19 and IFRIC 14. Now, some respondents think that the possibility that the surplus could be extinguished by events as a result of decisions by other parties is not relevant to assessing the existence of an entity's unconditional right to the surplus at the reporting date. These respondents think that taking these other parties' powers into consideration would not be consistent with some of the requirements, in particular the requirement not to anticipate changes to future benefits and the requirement to assume stable workforce. In addition, some respondents do not see a conceptual justification for treating powers that affect asset values, such as making investment decisions, differently from powers that affect the value of the liability, such as the decision to augment benefits. And those were the main concerns regarding inconsistencies. Some of the other concerns raised by respondents on inconsistencies are outlined in paragraph 28 to 31 of the agenda paper. At this stage, I would just like to pause for a minute and see if any committee members have any questions on any of the concerns that have been raised. If you think we need to clarify any aspects of any of the comments that were raised in this area.
Comments?
So, and just to clarify, we're focusing, aren't we, Javed, on sort of paragraphs 20 through to 31 in the paper?
Yeah, at the moment, 20 to 31 of the paper.
Okay, from those on the, Mary?
Sorry, I'll wait till you check with the other, with the interpretation committee.
Those on the phone, any additional points?
Nothing to add, thanks. Bertrand, do you have a question for the staff? Do you have any example of jurisdictions where such a case would occur, and in which specific circumstances it could occur?
Which
do you have? Do you have already make an assessment on that, or
which particular case are you referring to? Because this question started out as, because in a lot of cases the trustees have unilateral power to make decisions on benefits, and we had an outreach on that and identified several cases where this was present and there was diversity in practice. So is there a particular scenario that you're referring to?
No, it was more a general question.
Right.
Seems to me this came to us initially from the United Kingdom, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yep.
And yeah.
Mary?
And yeah, it's just that I wanted to confirm because it's what I supposed. And then is it a general case in the UK? It is generally the way it functions in the UK, or are there many ways of winding up a plan? And then in which circumstances would you end up having only the trustees deciding for the winding up of the plan?
Well, we have two UK practitioners in the room here. So I'll pick Tony first and then ask Andrew for comment.
And I don't think there is a sort of a universal, this applies to every plan in the UK, and it's going to vary depending on the rules of each plan. But the circumstances that are addressed by the amendments to IFRIC 14 are circumstances that do occur in practice in the UK, and people do look at these issues in different ways. So I think it is a valid issue for the committee to have addressed, and it is something that we do see in practice.
Andrew, anything to add to that?
No, I think that sums it up rather well. The only point that I would make is that the issues that are addressed, while the schemes have different characteristics in the UK, the issues are pretty widespread, and therefore it's not isolated to a very small population of schemes.
No, I understand that. I was poking referring to its genesis. Okay. Anybody else?
No, it was. I was asking the question just to comment why I'm asking the question. I'm not suggesting that the issue shouldn't be addressed by the committee. It's not my point. It's just that by experience, I know that the social regulation of pensions in the UK is quite complex, and so I was just wondering whether somebody could provide more insight so as for the members to better understand the circumstances when such an issue could arise. It was more to understand the legal environment, which is very specific for pensions in the UK, and to better appreciate that in the future.
I think that's a fair question. I think we have some previous board or interpretations committee papers. Sure. Perhaps we could highlight those for Bertrand. Now Mary wants to come in.
It's a suggestion for the staff as you prepare the staff analysis of the feedback. I see the biggest chunk that you've highlighted here in the summary of comments received is a repeated theme of concerns about the potential for conflicts within IS-19 with the proposals. And to me, looking at the comments, it seems that some of them might be confusing the recognition and measurement of these changes with the ability to make those changes being part of the assessment of whether the trustees, and I don't want to screw up the words, so I'll look back at the paragraph. I think it's in 4A, whether the entity has an unconditional right. And so I think when you're doing the analysis and looking at this, if you can, might be helpful to make a very clear distinction between factors relevant for the assessment of right versus factors relevant for the recognition and measurement. That just might help the subsequent discussion by the interpretation committee.
Absolutely, thank you.
Gary?
I think when you talk about the measurement of the surplus, you gotta decide, is this an accounting measurement or a statutory, you know, pension authorities definition, because they're often very, very different. And the amount, you know, if you're a trustee, the amount you can or can't make use of is probably driven much more by law than it is by accounting. And you could, for example, you get a very different measurements of the discount rate and very different ways to amortize gains and losses on assets. So I'm not suggesting what the answer should be, but I think it has to be worked by the staff and come back with a recommendation.
Fair point. Other suggestions? Okay, let's press on.
All right, moving on with paper 6A. So the second issue, which is noted in paragraph 32 to 41 of the agenda paper, relates to whether applying the proposed amendments would allow an entity to reflect the economic substance of defined benefit plans. In particular, some respondents think that the proposed amendments are too prescriptive and do not permit an entity to apply its own judgment. These respondents think that the exercise of judgment is necessary because of the complexity and the specific terms and conditions of each defined benefit plan. Additionally, several respondents think that an entity should consider other parties' powers only when the power is substantive or more likely than not to be executed. These respondents think that considering powers that only in theory provide power would not faithfully represent the economic substance of these plans. Some of the other substantive issues identified by respondents are noted in paragraph 42 to 47 of the agenda paper. Again, I'll just highlight a couple of these points very briefly. Some respondents think it's not clear how to distinguish powers that a trustee might have to purchase annuities as part of a wind-up of a plan, as opposed to powers that the trustee might have to purchase annuities as part of plan assets. Additionally, some respondents say that in practice, defined benefit plans are often controlled jointly between the by the entity and the trustee or another party. These respondents request the board to address whether these proposed amendments would also apply in those circumstances. So I would like to pause here again and ask if committee members have any questions on these issues. So starting from paragraph 32 on to paragraph 47 of the agenda paper.
Comments? On the phone, anybody? Tony?
Just an observation on the comments in issue two, or issue two and then issue three. I think it seems that some of them get to the principle that the committee will or won't agree with in the end about whether you or what you take into account to determine whether there's an unconditional right. Some of them are a lot more detailed and they get into the application of that principle. And a bit like Mary said, I think it would be good to separate one from the other when we're thinking about it. So address some when, okay, what's the principle that we will or won't agree with? And then how much detail do we want to think about in terms of application guidance for that principle?
Fair enough. Okay,
great.
Press on.
Yep, before I hand over to Khan to discuss agenda paper 6B, I would just also like to ask if committee members have any questions on the other issues which were identified in Appendix A of paper 6A.
Okay.
No one on the phone?
No one on the phone?
Perfect.
Okay. Khan?
Okay. I would now like to turn your attention to Agenda Paper 6B. Agenda Paper 6B provides a summary of the feedback received on the proposed amendment, IS-19. The first proposed amendment related to how an entity accounts for defined benefit plan when plan amendment, curtailment, or settlement, that is, plan event, occurs during a reporting period. The proposed amendment specifies that an entity should use updated assumption to calculate the current service cost and net interest when the entity remeasures net defined benefit liability. This is because the board was concerned that ignoring the effect of plan event does not result in useful information. These amendments are presented in Appendix B of the paper. The main issues identified by respondents in relation to these proposed amendments are the consequences of a minor plan amendment and inconsistency with the requirement in IS-34. These issues are discussed in paragraphs 19 to 37 of the paper. We will discuss each of them briefly. Firstly, consequences of a minor plan amendment, which is explained in paragraphs 20 to 33 of the agenda paper. Some respondents say that it is not clear how an entity would apply the general requirement about materiality in the context of the proposed amendment IS-19. Respondents are concerned that proposed amendment could lead to remeasurement triggered by only minor amendment to a plan or a portion of a plan. Additionally, some respondents say that the proposed amendment may reduce the comparability of the financial statement between entities with similar plans. If one entity has a minor plan amendment during the reporting period, while the other entity does not. Some respondents say that an entity should potentially be allowed to consider only the group of employees affected by plan event to be the unit of account to which the measurement requirement would apply. Some respondents also say that entity often adopt computational shortcut method permitted by IS-19 when a minor plan event occurs. These respondents think that an entity will now have to undertake a detailed, expensive, and onerous approach as the effect of remeasurement for minor plan event may be material. Secondly, inconsistency with IS-34, which is explained in paragraph 34 to 37 of the agenda paper. A large number of respondents comment that the decision not to address accounting in IS-19 when significant market fluctuation occur will result in divergent practice. Some respondents think that paragraph B9 of IS-34 should be amended for consistency with IS-19. The other issues raised by respondents for these proposed amendments are noted in Appendix A, paragraphs A2 to A17. Before moving on to the proposed amendment, IS-19 to address the interaction between asset sharing and past service cost or gain or loss on settlement, now I would like to take a pause here and ask if the committee members have any question on these issues. Thank you.
Okay, so we're up through paragraph 37, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Comments or questions? Anyone on the phone have comments or questions? Okay, let's press on.
Okay.
And any questions on appendix on this issue in Appendix A, paragraph A2 to A17, any of the other issues identified on this particular amendment? No?
Not appearing.
Okay. Okay, so I'll move on quickly to the second amendment that was made to IS-19, which deals with the interaction between the asset ceiling and the calculation of the past service cost or the gain or loss in settlement. So the committee and the board noted that the accounting for a plan event may cause a reduction or elimination of a surplus, which may mean in turn that the effect of the asset ceiling also changes. Consequently, the board decided to amend IS-19 to clarify that an entity recognizes past service cost or a gain or loss in settlement separately from its assessment of the asset ceiling. In other words, these two calculations are two distinct steps. So again, the main issues identified by respondents on these proposed amendments were outlined in paragraph 38 to 47 of the agenda paper. Some respondents think that the proposed amendments would lead to an inappropriate recognition of a gain or loss on settlement or past service cost. These respondents think that it is counterintuitive for an entity to recognize an amount in profit or loss from a surplus that has previously been determined as having no value to the entity. These respondents' concerns have been illustrated through an example, which is outlined in paragraph 41 to 43 of the agenda paper. In addition, some respondents say that recognizing a gain or loss on settlement or past service cost in profit or loss contradicts the requirements in paragraph 122 of IS-19, which prohibits recycling of amounts recognized in OCI. These respondents think that the proposed amendments effectively lead to recycling because the two steps, which is determining the gain or loss in settlement and the calculation of the asset ceiling, in their view, are inextricably linked when an entity is required to remeasure the net defined benefit obligation due to a plan event. Again, at this stage, I would just pause and ask if any committee members have any questions on this issue.
Any questions from those on the phone? Okay, you're on a roll.
Lastly, I would just like to ask if committee members have any other questions on the other issues that are identified in the appendix to paper 6B.
None appear.
That concludes.
All right, we will bring you back the staff analysis of comments in September.
That's what we're trying.
That's our plan.
That's our plan.
Oh, Martin.
Martin, excuse me.
Yeah, a more general question. Sometimes the term several is applied, sometimes some, and sometimes we have a concrete number. So what is more, several respondents or some respondents? And I mean, to judge on the paper, it would sometimes be helpful to have an idea what's more, what's less.
Yeah, in the context of the way we were writing this paper, several was definitely more than some. So several was more. Some was a few, and
but and several is the
anything over the majority, number we've written, and several was a lot of respondents, probably more like a majority of the respondents or a large number of respondents or several.
More than the majority are several or less than the majority?
Several was just a large number.
It depends, okay, yeah.
Yeah, several was just a large number and some was...
Yeah.
Okay.
We try very hard not to count noses, count votes.
Yeah.
And so we use some of these terms that are not as precise as perhaps we hope they would be, but the alternative is to say 15. And that's not something that historically either the board or the committee has wanted to do. So fair comment, but where we are. Anybody else? Okay, we'll see you in September, as the song used to say.